The statute mentions protection for Good Samaritan blocking and screening of offensive material. What Wyden and his colleagues could not have anticipated, and still do not grasp, is that the logic of this early controversy no longer holds. Neither CompuServe nor Prodigy was a surveillance capitalist, but many of today's internet intermediaries are committed to the pursuit of surveillance revenues. This fact fundamentally changes the relationship between the company and the content on its platforms, and it explains why surveillance capitalists cannot be compared to the New York Public Library as the neutral caretaker of Nabokov's venerated book. Far from it. Under the regime of surveillance capitalism, content is a source of behavioral surplus, as is the behavior of the people who provide the content, as are their patterns of connection, communication, and mobility, their thoughts and feelings, and the metadata expressed in their emoticons, exclamation points, lists, contractions, and salutations. That book on the bookshelf, along with the records of anyone who may have touched it and when, their location, behavior, networks, and so on, is now the diamond mine ready for excavation and plunder to be rendered into behavioral data and fed to the machines on their way to product fabrication and sales. Section 230's protection of the intermediaries now functions as another bulwark that shelters this extractive surveillance capitalist operation from critical examination. There is nothing neutral about the surveillance intermediary now, as the extraction imperative and its demand for economies of scale in surplus supply mean that the surveillance capitalists must use every means to attract a never-ending tide of content to their shores. They no longer merely host content, but aggressively, secretly, and unilaterally extract value from that content. As we shall see in Chapter 18, economic imperatives require them to forego as few of these raw materials as possible. That means moderating only those extremes that threaten the volume and velocity of surplus by repelling users or attracting regulatory scrutiny. This is the reason that firms such as Facebook, Google, and Twitter have been reluctant to remove even the most egregious content from their landscapes. And it helps to explain why lawyers for tech companies litigate ferociously to prevent even a sliver of erosion in Section 230. A statute once crafted to nurture an important new technological milieu is now the legal bulwark that protects the asymmetric wealth, knowledge, and power of a rogue capitalism. 4. Shelter. Surveillance exceptionalism. In his book Surveillance After September 11th, surveillance scholar David Lyon writes that in the aftermath of the attacks that day, existing surveillance practices were intensified and previous limits were lifted. After several decades in which data protection officials, privacy watchdogs, civil rights groups, and others have tried to mitigate negative social effects of surveillance, we are witnessing a sharp tilt toward more exclusionary and intrusive surveillance practices. This abrupt refocusing of governmental power and policy after the 9/11 attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C., is a second historical condition that lent shelter to the fledgling market form. Lyon's characterization is accurate. In the years before 9/11, the Federal Trade Commission emerged as the key actor defining the debate on internet privacy in the U.S. For reasons that we have already reviewed, the FTC favored self-regulation, and it cajoled internet companies to establish codes of conduct, privacy policies, and methods of enforcement. But the FTC eventually concluded that self-regulation would not be sufficient to protect individual consumers' privacy on the web. In 2000, still 1 year before the 9/11 attacks, Google's discovery of behavioral surplus, or the success of AdWords, a majority of FTC commissioners issued a report in which they recommended legislation to regulate online privacy. Because self-regulatory initiatives to date fall far short of broad-based implementation of self-regulatory programs. They wrote, The Commission has concluded that such efforts alone cannot ensure that the online marketplace as a whole will follow the standards adopted by industry leaders, notwithstanding several years of industry and governmental effort. The report noted that a mere 8% of popular websites featured a seal of approval from one of the industry privacy watchdogs. The commissioners proceeded to outline federal legislation that would have protected consumers online despite the dominant bias against regulation and in favor of treating internet operations as free speech. The recommendations demanded clear and conspicuous notice of information practices, consumer choice over how personal information is used, access to all personal information, including rights to correct or delete, and enhanced security of personal information. Had these been translated into law, it is quite possible that many of the foundational elements of surveillance capitalism would have been either plainly illegal or at least subject to public examination and consent. The FTC effort was short-lived. According to Peter Swire, chief counselor for privacy in the Clinton administration and later a member of President Obama's review group on intelligence and communication technologies, with the attacks of September 11, 2001, everything changed. The new focus was overwhelmingly on security rather than privacy. The privacy provisions debated just months earlier vanished from the conversation more or less overnight. In both the U.S. Congress and across the EU, legislation was quickly put in place that decisively expanded surveillance activities. The U.S. Congress passed the Patriot Act, created the terrorist screening program, and instituted a host of other measures that dramatically increased the warrantless collection of personal information. The events of 9/11 also triggered a steady stream of legislation that expanded the powers of intelligence and law enforcement agencies across Europe, including Germany, a country that had been highly sensitized to surveillance under the hammer of both Nazi and Stalinist totalitarianism, the UK, and France. In the US, the failure to connect the dots on the terrorist attack was a source of shame and dismay that overwhelmed other concerns. Policy guidelines shifted from need to know to need to share as agencies were urged to tear down walls and blend databases for comprehensive information and analysis. In a parallel development, privacy scholar Chris J. Hufnagel observes that the threat of comprehensive privacy legislation had also mobilized the business community and its lobbyists to either shape or stop any potential bill. In the post-9/11 political environment, the two forces converged for an easy victory. The Internet was the critical target. CIA Director Michael Hayden conceded as much in 2013 when he told an audience that in the years following 9/11, the CIA could be fairly charged with the militarization of the World Wide Web. Legislation to regulate online privacy was an immediate casualty. Mark Rotenberg, the director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, testified to the 9/11 Commission on the sudden reversal of privacy concerns, observing that before 9/11, there was hardly any positive discussion about the development of techniques that would enable massive surveillance while attempting to safeguard privacy. Swire concurred, noting that as a result of the new emphasis on information sharing, Congress lost interest in regulating information usage in the private sector. Without the threat of legislation, the energy went out of many of the self-regulatory efforts that industry had created. At the FTC, the focus shifted from the broader concerns of privacy rights to a more politically palatable, harms-based strategy, pursuing cases in which concrete physical harms or economic injuries could be defined, such as identity theft or database security. With legislation off the table, other forces shaped the political environment in which surveillance capitalism would root and grow. The 9/11 terrorist attacks thrust the intelligence community into an unfamiliar demand curve that insisted on exponential increases in velocity. For all its secrecy, even the NSA was subject to the temporalities and legal restrictions of a democratic state. The tempos of democracy are slow by design, weighted by redundancies, checks and balances, laws and rules. The agencies sought methods of deployment that could rapidly bypass legal and bureaucratic restrictions. In this environment of trauma and anxiety, a state of exception was invoked to legitimate a new imperative, speed at any cost. As Lyon put it, what 9/11 did was to produce socially negative consequences that hitherto were the stuff of repressive regimes and dystopian novels. The suspension of normal conditions is justified with reference to the war on terrorism. Critical to our story is the fact that this state of exception favored Google's growth and the successful elaboration of its surveillance-based logic of accumulation. Google's mission was to organize and make accessible the world's information, and by late 2001, the intelligence community established information dominance in the public's house, quickly institutionalizing it in hundreds of billions of dollars worth of state-sponsored global technology infrastructure, personnel, and practice. The contours of a new interdependency between public and private agents of information dominance began to emerge, one that is best understood through the lens of what the sociologist Max Weber once called an elective affinity, born of a mutual magnetism that originates in shared meanings, interests, and reciprocities. The elective affinity between public intelligence agencies and the fledgling surveillance capitalist Google blossomed in the heat of emergency to produce a unique historical deformity, surveillance exceptionalism. The 9/11 attacks transformed the government's interest in Google as practices that just hours earlier were careening toward legislative action were quickly recast as mission-critical necessities. Both institutions craved certainty and were determined to fulfill that craving in their respective domains at any price. These elective affinities sustained surveillance exceptionalism and contributed to the fertile habitat in which the surveillance capitalism mutation would be matured to prosperity. The elective affinity between public and private missions was evident as early as 2002, when former NSA Chief Admiral John Poindexter proposed his Total Information Awareness, TIA, program, with a vision that reads like an early guide to the foundational mechanisms of behavioral surplus capture and analysis. If terrorist organizations are going to plan and execute attacks against the United States, their people must engage in transactions, and they will leave signatures in this information space. We must be able to pick this signal out of the noise. The relevant information extracted from this data must be made available in large-scale repositories with enhanced semantic content for analysis to accomplish this task. As CIA Director George Tenet had declared in 1997, the CIA needs to swim in the valley, referring to the need to master the new technologies flowing from Silicon Valley. In 1999, it opened a CIA-funded venture firm in the Valley, Incutel, as a conduit for cutting-edge technologies. The operation was meant to be an agency experiment, but after 9/11, it became a critical source of new capabilities and relationships, including with Google. As Silicon Valley's Mercury News reported, there's a new urgency with the CIA to find technology that makes sense of all the unstructured data floating around on the internet and elsewhere. The agency can't train analysts quickly enough. Incutel's CEO described the government's agencies as scrambling and noted that we're in a state of hyperactivity now. Surveillance exceptionalism thrived in that hyperactivity. Poindexter's Total Information Awareness program did not obtain congressional support, but an analysis in the MIT Technology Review showed that many of the TIA initiatives were quietly reassigned to the Pentagon's Advanced Research and Development Activity, ARDA, which in 2002 received $64 million to fund a research program in novel intelligence from massive data. In 2004, the U.S. General Accounting Office surveyed 199 data mining projects across dozens of federal agencies, and more than 120 programs developed to collect and analyze personal data to predict individual behavior. The New York Times reported in 2006 that the intelligence agencies, backed by a $40 billion annual budget, regularly fielded secretive shopping expeditions to Silicon Valley in search of new data mining and analysis technologies. State security agencies sought ways to avail themselves of Google's rapidly developing capabilities and simultaneously use Google to further develop, commercialize, and diffuse security and surveillance technologies with proven intelligence value. If TIA could not be fully developed and integrated in Washington, parts of the job could be delegated to Silicon Valley and its standout in information dominance, Google. By late summer 2003, Google was awarded a $2.07 million contract to outfit the agency with Google search technology. According to documents obtained by Consumer Watchdog under the Freedom of Information Act, the NSA paid Google for a search appliance capable of searching 15 million documents in 24 languages. Google extended its services for another year at no cost in April 2004. In 2003, Google also began customizing its search engine under special contract with the CIA for its Intellink Management Office, overseeing top secret, secret, and sensitive but unclassified intranets for CIA and other IC agencies. Key agencies used Google systems to support an internal wiki called Intellipedia that allowed agents to share information across organizations as quickly as it was vacuumed up by the new systems. In 2004, Google acquired Keyhole, a satellite mapping company founded by John Henke, whose key venture backer was the CIA venture firm InQtel. Keyhole would become the backbone for Google Earth, and Henke would go on to lead Google Maps, including the controversial Street View project. In 2009, Google Ventures and InQtel both invested in a Boston-based startup, Recorded Future, that monitors every aspect of the web in real time in order to predict future events. Wired reported that it was the first time the CIA-backed venture firm and Google had funded the same startup, and that both firms had seats on Recorded Future's board of directors. In the decade that followed 9/11, surveillance exceptionalism was also expressed in the flattery of imitation, as the NSA tried to become more like Google, emulating and internalizing Google's capabilities in a variety of domains. In 2006, General Keith Alexander outlined his vision for a search tool called ICReach, that would allow unprecedented volumes of metadata to be shared and analyzed across the many agencies in the intelligence community. By late 2007, the program was piloted, boosting the number of communications events it shared from 50 billion to more than 850 billion. The system was designed with a Google-like search interface that enabled analysts to run searches against metadata selectors, and to extract vital behavioral surplus for analyses that could reveal social networks, patterns of life, and habits, and in general, predict future behavior. In 2007, two NSA analysts wrote an internal training manual on how to find information on the Internet. It expressed the agency's keen interest in all things Google, with a detailed chapter devoted to a deconstruction of Google search and the Google hacks that can uncover information not intended for public distribution. That year, the elective affinities that infused the intelligence community's interest in Google were also highlighted when Google research director and AI expert Peter Norvig presented at a Pentagon Highlands Forum meeting, an exclusive networking event where military and intelligence officials commune with members of the high-tech industry, elected officials, elite academics, top corporate executives, and defense contractors. In 2001, the forum's director, Richard O'Neill, described its work to a Harvard audience as an idea engine. So the ideas that emerge from meetings are available for use by decision makers as well as by people from the think tanks. It was to be a bridge between the government and commercial leaders, especially in Silicon Valley. According to one highly detailed account by investigative journalist Nafiz Ahmed and cited by legal scholar Marianne Franks, the forum was both a support system and an incubator of Google's growth, as well as a connecting and convening force for the Pentagon, intelligence agencies, and the young company. The U.S. intelligence community's incubation of Google from inception occurred through a combination of direct sponsorship and informal networks of financial influence, themselves closely aligned with Pentagon interests. Another legal scholar described the collaboration between Google and the intelligence community, especially the NSA, as unprecedented. During these years, scholars noted the growing interdependencies between the intelligence agencies, resentful of constitutional constraints on their prerogatives, and the Silicon Valley firms. The agencies craved the lawlessness that a firm such as Google enjoyed. In his 2008 essay, The Constitution in the National Surveillance State, law professor Jack Balkin observed that the Constitution inhibits government actors from high-velocity pursuit of their surveillance agenda, and this creates incentives for the government to rely on private enterprise to collect and generate information for it. Balkin noted that the Supreme Court has imposed few privacy restrictions on business records and information that people give to third parties. Email is typically held in private servers, making its protection limited, if not non-existent. This absence of law made private companies attract partners for government actors bound to democratic constraints. The government's need to evade constitutional oversight, argues legal scholar John Michaels, leads to secret public-private intelligence collaborations that tend to be orchestrated around handshakes rather than legal formalities such as search warrants, and may be arranged this way to evade oversight and, at times, to defy the law. He observed that intelligence agencies are irresistibly drawn to, and in some respects dependent upon, firms' privately held data resources. Both scholars' observations were confirmed in 2010 when former NSA Director Mike McConnell offered another glimpse into the elective affinities between Google and the intelligence community. Writing in the Washington Post, McConnell made clear that Google's surveillance-based operations in data capture, extraction, and analysis were both taken for granted and coveted. Here, the boundaries of private and public melt in the intense heat of new threats and their high-velocity demands that must be met in milliseconds. In McConnell's future, there is one seamless surveillance empire in which the requirements of self-preservation leave no opportunity for the amenities of democracy, with its time-wasting practices of due process, evidence, warrants, and law. As McConnell insisted, an effective partnership with the private sector must be formed so information can move quickly back and forth from public to private and classified to unclassified, to protect the nation's critical infrastructure. Recent reports of possible partnership between Google and the government point to the kind of joint efforts and shared challenges that we are likely to see in the future. Such arrangements will muddy the waters between the traditional roles of the government and the private sector. Cyberspace knows no borders, and our defensive efforts must be similarly seamless. In the final months of the Obama administration, then-Secretary of Defense Ash Carter toured Silicon Valley, where he announced a new Defense Innovation Advisory Board meant to formalize a channel between the tech executives and the DOD. Carter appointed Schmidt to the new board and tasked him with selecting its members. As Wired concluded, "The government needs Silicon Valley more than ever as it seeks to defend from security threats in cyberspace." These facts are amply illustrated in a comprehensive treatment of bulk collection by an international group of scholars and edited by Indiana University's Fred Kate and Berkeley's James Dempsey. Kate and Dempsey note the expansive aggression of personal data in the hands of private companies. Governments understandably want access to this data. Essentially, every government in the world claims the power to compel disclosure of this data by the companies that hold it. Had it not been for surveillance exceptionalism, it is possible that these data would not even exist, at least not in their current volume and detail. Surveillance exceptionalism helped to shape the evolutionary course of information capitalism by creating an environment in which Google's budding surveillance practices were coveted rather than contested. Once again, history offers us no control groups, and we cannot know with certainty whether information capitalism might have developed in a different direction had it not been for the sudden new interest in surveillance capabilities. For now, it appears that one unanticipated consequence of this public-private elective affinity was that the fledgling practices of surveillance capitalism were allowed to root and grow with little regulatory or legislative challenge, emboldening Google's young leaders to insist on lawlessness as a natural right, and, in ways that are even more opaque, emboldening the state to grant them that freedom. Powerful elective affinities favored the acquisition of certainty at any price, and part of that price appears to have been the shelter of surveillance capitalism. In the fullness of time, historians will no doubt discover the specifics of these relationships and the ways in which Google's discoveries in the capture and use of behavioral surplus were sheltered from scrutiny, at least in part because of this new habitat of militarized demand. In the context of new military purpose, the digital capabilities that were aimed toward the advocacy-oriented values of the behavioral value reinvestment cycle flowed toward surveillance without impediment. Surveillance assets thrived without risk of sanction and attracted surveillance capital. Revenue followed. The situation recalls the auto, steel and machine tool industries at mid-century when military orders kept plants operating at full capacity. In the end, however, this turned out to be more curse than blessing. Military demand distorted and suppressed the innovation process and drove a wedge between these industries and their civilian customers, leaving them vulnerable to foreign competitors in the globalizing markets of the late 1970s and early 1980s. Similarly, under the conditions of surveillance exceptionalism, Google's leaders were not compelled to undertake the arduous and risky work of inventing an exchange-based, advocacy-oriented market form when the surveillance model was so lucrative. Why risk experimentation with more organic paths to monetization when surveillance and extraction operations were safe from law and hugely profitable? Eventually, it wasn't just Google asking these questions. Every other internet business faced the same choices. Once surveillance revenues set the bar for venture capitalists and Wall Street analysts, it became that much easier for internet companies to go with the flow. Then it became onerous not to. 5. Fortifications. Why is it that so many years after the events that triggered the mania for information dominance, surveillance capitalism still runs with relatively little impediment, especially in the U.S.? The intervening years have seen the proliferation of thousands of institutional facts that normalized surveillance capitalism's practices and made them appear necessary and inevitable. The discovery of behavioral surplus and the massive accumulations of capital and material that followed, the proliferation of devices and services, the integration of data flows, and the institutionalization of futures markets in human behavior. This does not mean that we should succumb to the natural fallacy and interpret this flourishing as a signal of surveillance capitalism's inherent worthiness or inevitability. In the coming chapters, we will uncover many additional factors that have contributed to this success. But here I want to focus on Google's proactive efforts to build fortifications around its supply chains in order to protect surplus flows from challenge. Although many elements of this fortification strategy have been well publicized, their importance for our story lies in the fact that each is one aspect of a multi-pronged effort that deflects scrutiny from core operations in order to maintain the flow of free, unregulated behavioral surplus. Fortifications have been erected in four key arenas to protect Google and eventually other surveillance capitalists from political interference and critique. 1. The demonstration of Google's unique capabilities as a source of competitive advantage in electoral politics. 2. A deliberate blurring of public and private interests through relationships and aggressive lobbying activities. 3. A revolving door of personnel who migrated between Google and the Obama administration, united by elective affinities during Google's crucial growth years of 2009 to 2016. And 4. Google's intentional campaign of influence over academic work and the larger cultural conversation so vital to policy formation, public opinion, and political perception. The results of these four arenas of defense contribute to an understanding of how surveillance capitalism's facts came to stand and why they continue to thrive. First, Google demonstrated that the same predictive knowledge derived from behavioral surplus that had made the surveillance capitalists wealthy could also help candidates win elections. To make the point, Google was ready to apply its magic to the red-hot core of 21st century campaigning, beginning with the 2008 Obama presidential campaign. Schmidt had a leading role in organizing teams and guiding the implementation of cutting-edge data strategies that would eclipse the traditional political arts with the science of behavioral prediction. Indeed, at Obama's Chicago headquarters, they remodeled the electorate in every battleground state each weekend. Field staff could see the event's impact on the projected behaviors and beliefs of every voter nationwide. Research by media scholars Daniel Kreese and Philip Howard indicates that the 2008 Obama campaign compiled significant data on more than 250 million Americans, including a vast array of online behavioral and relational data collected from use of the campaign's website and third-party social media sites such as Facebook. Journalist Sasha Eisenberg, who documented these developments in his book The Victory Lab, quotes one of Obama's 2008 political consultants, who likened predictive modeling to the tools of a fortune teller. "We knew who people were going to vote for before they decided." Obama used his proximity to Schmidt to cement his own identity as the innovation candidate, poised to disrupt business as usual in Washington. Once elected, Schmidt joined the Transition Economic Advisory Board and appeared next to Obama at his first post-election press conference. According to Politico, the image alone of Schmidt standing elbow to elbow with Obama's top economic thinkers was enough to send shivers up the spine of Google's competitors. "This terrifies Microsoft," said a Democratic lobbyist familiar with the industry. "There's a reason why people are scared to death of Google." Schmidt's role in President Obama's election was but one chapter in a long and by now fabled relationship that some have described as a love affair. Not surprisingly, Schmidt took on an even more prominent role in the 2012 re-election campaign. He led in fundraising and in breaking new technical ground, and he personally oversaw the voter turnout system on election night. Political correspondent Jim Rutenberg's New York Times account of the data scientist's seminal role in the 2012 Obama victory offers a vivid picture of the capture and analysis of behavioral surplus as a political methodology. The campaign knew every single wavering voter in the country that it needed to persuade to vote for Obama, by name, address, race, sex, and income, and it had figured out how to target its television ads to these individuals. One breakthrough was the persuasion score that identified how easily each undecided voter could be persuaded to vote for the Democratic candidate. The facts of behavioral surplus and its predictive power were kept top secret in the Obama campaigns, just as they are in Google, Facebook, and other domains of information dominance. As Rutenberg observed, the extent to which the campaign used the newest tech tools to look into people's lives and the sheer amount of personal data its vast servers were crunching remained largely shrouded. The secrecy was partly to maintain their competitive edge, but it was also, no doubt, because they worried that practices like data mining and analytics could make voters uncomfortable. Second, with the 2012 election in sight, an interview with the Washington Post in 2011 found Schmidt boasting about another fortification strategy. "The staffers are young. The staffers get it. So that's what we depend on. And of course we've hired ex-staffers as well. They all know each other, so that's how it really works." Google's political utilities paved the way for the unusually crowded and fast-spinning revolving door between the East Coast and West Coast centers of power. The Google Transparency Project analyzed the movement of staff between the Google sphere, the company plus its affiliates and its laws and lobbying firms, and the government, including the White House, Congress, government agencies, federal commissions, and national political campaigns during the Obama years. It found that by April 2016, 197 individuals had migrated from the government into the Google sphere, and 61 had moved in the other direction. Among these, 22 White House officials went to work for Google, and 31 Google Sphere executives joined the White House or federal advisory boards with direct relevance to Google's business. Third, just to be on the safe side, Google shared its largesse throughout the political system. In Schmidt's 2014 book, co-authored with longtime Google executive Jonathan Rosenberg, the CEO aggressively developed the theme of government as the shill of incumbents colluding to inhibit change, with Google on the outside, an upstart and a disruptor. The authors voiced their disdain for politicians and lobbyists, writing, "This is the natural path of politicians, since incumbents tend to have a lot more money than disruptors and are quite expert in using it to bend the political will of any democratic government." That same year, while Schmidt disparaged incumbents and their political sway, Google spent more on lobbying than any other corporation, over $17 million, and nearly twice as much as surveillance rival Facebook. In the next few years, as the White House changed hands, Google maintained its pace, outspending every other company with a more than $18 million lobbying outlay in 2018, as the company fended off privacy legislation and other initiatives that might impede its freedom to capture and process behavioral surplus. Google was also among the wealthiest of all registered lobbyists in the EU, second only to a lobbying group that represents a confederation of European corporations. The firm also learned to engineer sophisticated lobbying efforts at the state level, primarily geared to fight back any proposed legislation that would augment privacy and curtail behavioral surplus operations. For example, Google won the right to put its self-driving cars on the road, anticipated as important supply chains, after enlisting Obama officials to lobby state regulators for key legislation. Both Google and Facebook currently lead aggressive state-level lobbying campaigns aimed at repelling or weakening statutes to regulate biometric data and protect privacy. As one report put it, they want your body. In the fourth arena of fortifications, the corporation learned to infiltrate and influence academic research and civil society advocacy in ways that softened or, in some cases, thwarted the examination of its practices. The Washington Post describes Google as a master of Washington influence and notes the subtlety with which the firm grasps and directs its own narrative. Schmidt was hands-on in this work as well. Already a board member of the New America Foundation, a public policy think tank that played an influential role in shaping the Obama administration's approach to economic issues, he assumed the chairmanship in 2013 with a personal donation of $1 million, a significant percentage of its $12.9 million annual budget that year. Between 1999 and 2016, when Schmidt left the board, the foundation received $21 million from a combination of Google, Schmidt, and Schmidt's family foundation. The Washington Post published an elaborate exposé of Google's meticulous work in this fourth domain, illustrated in the backstage intrigues that accompanied a three-part series on internet search competition held at George Mason University's Law and Economics Center, a free market-oriented academic center that had received significant funding from Google. The meetings occurred in May 2012, just as the FTC was investigating the Google antitrust case. Reporters found that company staffers worked closely with the center, choosing pro-Google speakers and participants, many of whom were Google employees. Their efforts included sending the center's staff a detailed spreadsheet listing members of Congress, FTC commissioners, and senior officials with the Justice Department and State Attorney General's office. Reporters noted that the conference's panels were dominated by leading technology and legal experts who forcefully rejected the need for government action against Google, making their arguments before some of the very regulators who would help determine its fate. Many participants had no idea that Google was involved in crafting the meetings, because Google and center staffers had agreed to conceal the corporation's backstage involvement. The FTC antitrust investigation appears to have heightened Google's fears of a regulatory threat to surveillance capitalism. That year, Google's grant-making operation aimed at civil society organizations took an aggressive turn. According to the Center for Media and Democracy's investigatory research report, The Googleization of the Far Right, the corporation's 2012 list of grantees featured a new group of anti-government groups known for their opposition to regulation and taxes and their support for climate change denial, including Grover Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform, the Koch brothers-funded Heritage Action, and other anti-regulatory groups such as the Federalist Society and the Cato Institute. The corporation also quietly acknowledged its membership in the corporate lobbying group ALEC, known for its opposition to gun control and emissions curbs, and for its support for voter suppression schemes, tobacco industry tax breaks, and other far-right causes. Meanwhile, a list of Google Policy Fellows for 2014 included individuals from a range of nonprofit organizations whom one would expect to be leading the fight against that corporation's concentrations of information and power, including the Center for Democracy and Technology, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Future of Privacy Forum, the National Consumers League, the Citizen Lab, and the Asociación por los Derechos Civiles. In July 2017, the Wall Street Journal reported that since 2009, Google had actively sought out and provided funding to university professors for research and policy papers that support Google's positions on matters related to law, regulation, competition, patents, and so forth. In many cases, Google weighed in on the papers before publication, and some of the authors did not disclose Google as a source of funding. Although Google publicly claimed that the check came with no requirements, another case in 2017 belied that notion. That summer, one of the New America Foundation's most highly regarded scholars and a specialist in digital monopolies, Barry Lynn, posted a statement praising the EU's historic decision to levy a $2.7 billion fine on Google as the result of a multi-year antitrust investigation. According to the New York Times and Lynn's own account, New America's director bent to pressure from Schmidt, firing Lynn and his open markets team of 10 researchers. Google is very aggressive in throwing its money around Washington and Brussels and then pulling strings, Lynn told the New York Times. People are so afraid of Google now. The reporters cite Google's muscular and sophisticated influence operation as surpassing any other U.S. companies. With Google in the lead, surveillance capitalism vastly expanded the market dynamic as it learned to expropriate human experience and translate it into coveted behavioral predictions. Google and this larger surveillance project have been birthed, sheltered, and nurtured to success by the historical conditions of their era, second modernity needs, the neoliberal inheritance, and the realpolitik of surveillance exceptionalism, as well as by their own purpose-built fortifications designed to protect supply chain operations from scrutiny through political and cultural capture. Surveillance capitalism's ability to keep democracy at bay produced these stark facts. Two men at Google who do not enjoy the legitimacy of the vote, democratic oversight, or the demands of shareholder governance, exercise control over the organization and presentation of the world's information. One man at Facebook who does not enjoy the legitimacy of the vote, democratic oversight, or the demands of shareholder governance, exercises control over an increasingly universal means of social connection, along with the information concealed in its networks. Chapter 5. The Elaboration of Surveillance Capitalism. Kidnap, Corner, Compete. All words like peace and love, all sane affirmative speech, had been spoiled, profaned, debased to a horrid mechanical screech. W. H. Auden. We, too, had known golden hours. 1. The Extraction Imperative. Our ultimate ambition is to transform the overall Google experience, making it beautifully simple, Larry Page said. Almost auto-magical because we understand what you want and can deliver it instantly. In the drive to fulfill this ambition, the extraction imperative produces a relentless push for scale in supply operations. There can be no boundaries that limit scale in the hunt for behavioral surplus. No territory exempted from plunder. The assertion of decision rights over the expropriation of human experience, its translation into data, and the uses of those data are collateral to this process, inseparable as a shadow. This explains why Google's supply chain began with search, but steadily expanded to encompass new and even more ambitious territories far from clicks and queries. Google's stores of behavioral surplus now embrace everything in the online milieu. Searches, emails, texts, photos, songs, messages, videos, locations, communication patterns, attitudes, preferences, interests, faces, emotions, illnesses, social networks, purchases, and so on. A new continent of behavioral surplus is spun each moment from the many virtual threads of our everyday lives as they collide with Google, Facebook, and, more generally, every aspect of the Internet's computer-mediated architecture. Indeed, under the direction of surveillance capitalism, the global reach of computer mediation is repurposed as an extraction architecture. This process originated online, but has spread to the real world as well, a fact that we will examine more closely in Part 2. If Google is a search company, why is it investing in smart home devices, wearables, and self-driving cars? If Facebook is a social network, why is it developing drones and augmented reality? This diversity sometimes confounds observers, but is generally applauded as a visionary investment. Far-out bets in the future. In fact, activities that appear to be varied and even scattershot across a random selection of industries and projects are usually all the same activity, guided by the same aim, behavioral surplus capture. Each is a slightly different configuration of hardware, software, algorithms, sensors, and connectivity designed to mimic a car, shirt, cell phone, book, video, robot, chip, drone, camera, cornea, tree, television, watch, nanobot, intestinal flora, or any other online service. But they all share the same purpose, behavioral surplus capture. Google is a shapeshifter, but each shape harbors the same aim, to hunt and capture raw material. Baby, won't you ride my car? Talk to my phone, wear my shirt, use my map. In all these cases, the varied torrent of creative shapes is the sideshow to the main event. The continuous expansion of the extraction architecture to acquire raw material at scale to feed an expensive production process that makes prediction products that attract and retain more customers. When confronted in 2008 with a question about why Google had 150 products, its CEO Eric Schmidt responded, "That can be stated as criticism, but it can also be stated as strategy. The goal of the company is customer satisfaction. You should think of Google as one product, customer satisfaction. Those customers are the world's advertisers and others who pay for its predictions. Customer satisfaction, therefore, equates to Google's dominant market share in lucrative new behavioral futures markets, fed by its ever-expanding extraction architecture. New supply routes are continuously constructed and tested, and only some go operational. Routes that reliably produce scale, such as the Android smartphone operating system or Gmail, are elaborated and institutionalized. Those that fail are shuttered or modified. If one route is blocked, another is found. Successful supply routes double as canvases for targeted advertising, expanding the reach of behavioral futures markets and simultaneously engaging users in ways that yield yet more behavioral surplus. There will always be a changing roster of supply routes, but all variations share the same operational mandate: the capture of behavioral surplus and the acquisition of decision rights. Like a river running to the sea, if one route is blocked, another is found. In this chapter, we follow the consequences of the extraction imperative as it drives the elaboration of the new market form and its competitive dynamics. The imperative elevates surplus supply operations to a defining role in every aspect of the surveillance capitalist enterprise. This begins with a continuous parade of innovations aimed at cornering raw material supplies. Cornering is not simply a technological achievement. Sustainable dispossession requires a highly orchestrated and carefully phased amalgam of political, communicative, administrative, legal and material strategies that audaciously asserts and tirelessly defends claims to new ground. The success of these strategies, first at Google and later at Facebook, established both their feasibility and their rewards, drawing new competitors into an increasingly ruthless cycle of kidnapping human experience, cornering surplus supplies, and competing in new behavioral futures markets. 2. Cornered. The discovery of behavioral surplus in 2001 to 2002 meant that Google Search would be the first Google service to be recrafted as a supply route. The resulting shifts in the mechanisms of search were nearly impossible for people to imagine, let alone detect. When Harvard Business School's Benjamin Edelman researched these hidden mechanisms in 2010, he found that the enhanced features option of a product called Google Toolbar, a plugin for Microsoft's Internet Explorer web browser that lets users search without having to go to Google.com, transmits to the company the full URL of every page view, including searches at competing search engines. Edelman discovered that it was strikingly easy to activate this option, but impossible to disable it. Even when a user specifically instructed that the toolbar be disabled, and even when it appeared to be disabled because it had disappeared from view, the toolbar continued to track browsing behavior. As Google now hosts trillions of searches annually, its varied search-related tracking mechanisms, combined with its robust and nearly inescapable cookies, bits of tracking code inserted in your computer, ensure immense economies of scale that constitute the bedrock of Google's supply operations. In 2015, internet legal scholar Tim Wu joined Harvard Business School's Michael Luca and a team of data scientists from Yelp to research hidden mechanisms in Google search that function, from our perspective, to expand crucial supply functions. They discovered that Google was systematically corrupting search results to favor its own content and downstream products. Google has begun to develop its own content over time, such as its own price results for shopping and its own reviews for local businesses. Google is acting both as a search engine and a content provider. To use its search dominance to promote this content, Google has developed a feature called Universal Search, through which it intentionally excludes content competitors and only shows Google's content. The ceaseless requirement for surplus at scale predicts corporate behavior that favors exclusivity. Because search is the foundation of Google's supply operations, the company has every incentive to entice users to its search platform, content, and ancillary services, and then to use its backstage methods, apparatus, and data structures for efficient extraction. The tilt toward exclusivity produces a range of practices considered monopolistic in the perspective of 20th century regulatory frameworks. These characterizations, while valid, omit the most salient elements of the new order. The extraction imperative demands that everything be processed. In this new context, goods and services are merely surveillance-bound supply routes. It's not the car, it's the behavioral data from driving the car. It's not the map, it's the behavioral data from interacting with the map. The ideal here is continuously expanding borders that eventually describe the world and everything in it all the time. Traditionally, monopolies on goods and services disfigure markets by unfairly eliminating competition in order to raise prices at will. Under surveillance capitalism, however, many of the practices defined as monopolistic actually function as means of cornering user-derived raw material supplies. There is no monetary price for the user to pay, only an opportunity for the company to extract data. Cornering practices are not designed to protect product niches, but rather to protect critical supply routes for the unregulated commodity that is behavioral surplus. In another time, rogue market actors might corner markets in copper or magnesium, but in our time, it is behavioral surplus. The corporation unfairly impedes competitors in search in order to protect the dominance of its most important supply route, not primarily to fix prices. These cornering operations are not abstractions with distant effects on minerals or crops that eventually wind their way toward the price of goods. In this picture, it is we who are cornered. We are the source of the coveted commodity. Our experience is the target of extraction. As surveillance capitalism migrates from Silicon Valley to a range of other firms and sectors, we gradually find ourselves in a world of no escape, cornered by converging, overlapping, and relentlessly expanding dispossession operations. It is important to say, and we will revisit this theme more than once, that regulatory interventions designed to constrain Google's monopoly practices are likely to have little effect on the fundamental operations of this market form. New supply routes are continuously discovered, opened, and secured. Dispossession activities are compelled to circumvent every obstacle and will continue to do so short of a genuine existential threat. Google's Android mobile platform offers an example of the governing role of surplus capture and defense. Internet use went mobile with the rise of the smartphone and the tablet, and Google was forced to find new ways to defend and expand its primary supply chain in search. Android quickly became the corporation's second critical supply route for behavioral surplus. In 2008, Google led an alliance of technology manufacturers and wireless operators to develop an open and comprehensive platform for mobile devices. Some observers thought that an Android phone was Google's opportunity to compete with Apple for the lucrative margins on smartphones, but Google insiders had grasped the even greater potential for growth and profit through behavioral surplus and its fabrication into prediction products. Google licensed Android to mobile handset makers for free because it was intended to draw users into Google Search and other Google services, establishing a ubiquitous mobile supply apparatus to sustain known terrains of behavioral surplus and open up new ones, including geolocation and mobile payment systems that are highly coveted by advertisers. As Google's chief financial officer told financial analysts in 2009, if we move forward the adoption of these mobile phones by lowering the cost because it is open source, think of how many searches that will produce. A prominent Silicon Valley venture capitalist described Android devices in 2011 as not products in the classic business sense. They are not trying to make a profit on Android. They want to take any layer that lives between them.